You're about to hear the Healthy Planet radio program. But before that time, I want to urge you to take part in Radiothon. Radiothon is your opportunity to help WUSB put forth this amazing, growth-promoting, health-saving programming 24/7 all year long. You can call to support us at 631-632-6901 or online at WUSB.fm. I'll repeat those numbers, 631-632-6901 and online at WUSB.fm. If you're getting value out of these programs, and I know you are, then you need to call. Because that's how this volunteer-run, commercial-free radio station stays on the air. WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. So today's show is about what is arguably one of the most important topics you'll hear on a radio show in your entire life. I know it's a big claim, but it's one that I stand by. And yet, while it's incredibly important, as you'll see once I tell you what it is, it's not something that you'll likely hear on the news too frequently, except in special situations. It's not something you'll hear from politicians in terms of what we're going to do in our next 4 years in office. And it's not likely something you talk to your family and friends too much about. And yet it relies upon us talking about it to get it changed. It is a topic that I pledged decades ago to talk about, and I have since included it in just about every lecture I've done to people of all ages. And what makes it so important is not only that it's a social issue that causes an enormous amount of suffering on our planet, day after day, year after year, ever since I've been alive, but one that, while very complex, is an issue that is within our power to collectively do something about. But that's if, again, only if we all understand the reasons for its existence in the first place, and if we talk about it. And that's why we're bringing you this show. And the issue is world hunger. The sad reality is that we've all gotten used to hunger in far-off places simply because it's the norm. And with that complacency comes a sense of powerlessness to do something about what we all agree is a condition that is unacceptable in a world where we have enough land and resources to feed everybody. And we think in the background, oh, certainly if there was a possible solution, the powers that be would have taken care of it by this time. But that hasn't happened. So it is up to us to talk and talk and talk. And while nobody wants to think about people being underfed, I will urge you to stay with us. It used to be don't touch that dial, but now it's don't touch that button on your radio. Because again, the first step to doing something about this issue is to work on collective awareness about the nature of the problem and how we can all be part of creating solutions. I'm happy to say that joining us to discuss this weighty topic in a context of hope and solutions is someone who is well suited to the task, having herself spent decades educating on these issues. Her name is Dawn Moncrief. She's the founder and president of A Well-Fed World, an international hunger relief and food security organization advancing the benefits of plant-based foods and farming. For more than two decades, her work has highlighted the ways in which the consumption and production of animal-sourced foods increased economic disparities and exacerbate global hunger, especially for women and girls. Dawn has presented throughout the US, UK, Europe, and Africa. Her publications include contributions in Food Justice, a primer, Striking at the Roots, Circles of Compassion, and The Reducitarian Solution. So welcome back to The Healthy Planet, Dawn Moncrief.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Bob. It's been much too long. I'm glad we're finally able to connect.
It's really good to have you back. And it's, as I've mentioned to you earlier, it's been 11 years. And I've thought about you frequently during those times. And it was time to have you back, especially because the topic of food insecurity and food crises has been brought to the fore again with what's going on in Ukraine and Russia and with COVID. So it is time.
Yes.
So Dawn, start out by telling our listeners what the organization that you founded, A Well-Fed World, is all about, and how you got involved in doing this work in the first place.
Yeah, thank you. So at Well-Fed World, we are 15 years old ourselves as an organization, but as we discussed, I've actually been doing the work longer than that. I did my graduate school work in the late 90s. I have a master's degree in international relations and then a second one in women's studies, which was focused on economic development. So that's why there's also a particular focus on women and girls and the ways in which hunger disproportionately impacts them, which is just kind of standard. Anytime there's a scarcity or kind of inequality, a lot of the times that will fall along gender and or racial lines. And certainly hunger falls along both.
Right.
I'm actually from Florida originally, but I was up in DC for grad school and had wanted to work at the World Bank. I always wanted to work on global hunger issues. I was, you know, in formative years during the Ethiopian famine in the 80s. And just really, you know, impacted by that. And my mom also was a social worker. And so just always like the kind of the immense, unnecessary and unconscionable, you know, existence, like you're saying, it's been an existence as long as we know. When you were talking about the news and how it's, you know, it's not in the news because it's not new and we're just used to it being there.
Exactly.
But there's like 24,000 people dying every day of hunger and hunger related causes. That's remained pretty steady. And it does increase and decrease, but not actually as much as we might think. So one of the things we do cover with the Well-Fed World is that a lot of it has to do with the counting. And there's a lot of politics in how hunger is counted. And so it's actually much worse than even what we realize. A lot of times I think, you know, the common perception of global hunger is, you know, children in Africa starving. And we try to be really careful, like I said, of, you know, dying of hunger and hunger-related causes, that it's not just starving.
Right.
And that actually, if you were to talk about food insecurity and not having access to enough food on a regular basis, it actually could be closer to half the world's population are undernourished and undercaloried. And the scope of it's just mind-blowing. You know, even in the U.S., we have hunger, though it's not at the kind of scale that you think of when you think of famine in Africa. You know, a lot of times we think of conflict, but that traditionally is about 10% of hunger is related to conflict. So it's just a systemic, not caring enough, not making it a priority. There's also politics involved. You think like, why aren't people in their own countries doing more? But again, even in the U.S., we don't care enough to make sure everybody is properly nourished and properly fed. When you have poor countries, a lot of times it's there are benefits to keeping your population not empowered if you have government that is, you know, you don't want the people rising up. But also it's just in terms of having foreign exchange. So a lot of times, you know, the people, the elites, you have elite connections where if they need luxury products or they need military, they have to have something to exchange on the market. And so that's why you'll have countries that are where their own people are hungry will still be actually exporting food to that way they can get foreign exchange so that they can get the luxury products or the military products that they want into the country. So they have to have something to exchange. And, you know, that's one of the things that had just got me with Ethiopia, as we were talking about that, when I learned that during the famine, Ethiopia was actually exporting food. A lot of times these countries are exporting food to be used as animal feed to feed wealthier populations. So middle and higher income populations being fed meat products, but the food, the animal feed is coming from the countries. And that actually is still happening. That wasn't just this isolated case like, oh, during the Ethiopian famine, they actually happened to be exporting food. No, today still you have countries with high food insecurity that are exporting food. And it's not just food for animal feed, but that is part of it. A lot of times there's like a scarcity versus distribution type mentality. And the people are like, no, there's plenty of food. It's distribution, not scarcity. But the amount of food being used, it's a form of redistribution. Where is that food going? And so that it's causing regional and pockets of scarcity because it's being distributed away from people being fed directly to be used for animal feed. So anyway, I was going to work for the World Bank. That was the idea. But I had already been vegetarian as a teenager because I cared about the animals. But like a lot of people, I thought, well, it's one thing for me to be vegetarian, but I wouldn't say people who, you know, are in Africa would need to be vegetarian, right? They need to be able to eat whatever they can get hold of. And I would still say that's actually true. But when I started looking in on it and realizing with the Diet for a Small Planet and the resources being used and how actually we were going in and extracting food, that food was being exported from the countries to be used for animal feed, to make wealthy populations have access to meat products, and that it was connected. And then the environmental destruction that comes from either having the exported food, or if they also will do raising meat and dairy in other countries and exporting that directly, so it's not just animal feed, and the environmental consequences and how that undermines local food security, and that it was connected, and that there was research I was reading in 1999. There was a paper called Livestock to 2020, where it was talking about this increased global meat consumption and how all the devastating consequences that were coming from it. But they don't say, hey, we should eat less meat. This is still true. It's starting to become a little bit better. Again, we'll touch on that. But they were saying, how can we make these consequences less severe? What can we do? What can we do technology-wise to make meat not be so environmentally destructive? And what can we do in terms of controlling population so that there are fewer people eating less meat so that it's not as destructive? And once you start talking about population, and I mean, population is, I'm sure you could do this multiple shows on just population. It's, you know, it's very complicated and can be controversial, but just anytime we talk about population, we have to talk about per capita consumption. So I just will not let anybody in the US or the wealthier countries start saying, well, we have to have population control. And then it gets pointed again towards like Africa and Asia and the high population, relatively high population growth rates. And that's causing pressure on the food system. When you talk about per capita consumption, we eat so much more per person. So you can never talk about the problem of population and food supply if you're not looking at the per capita consumption and then also meat consumption, which is itself a form of overconsumption because it's so resource intensive. So
which
I'm almost
we'll talk done. About. Yeah.
Yes. And so anyway, when I realized like, hey, you know, I'm reading this research, why aren't they saying people to reduce it? They said, it's just demand driven. So we just have to deal with it. And that's when I realized, you know, if I'm working at the World Bank, I'm just going to be a cog in the wheel. I'm not really going to be able to do the kinds of things, the meaningful structural change that I think needs to happen. And so that's where I just then geared the research I was doing towards the benefits of plant-based foods and farming and realizing that for every reason, and I'm somebody who can see multiple sides of things. So for every reason, plant-based foods and farming are ideal. They're the best, whether it's personal health, environment, resource use, pollution. Of course, now greenhouse gases were much more aware of nutritionally, and then now also in terms of global food security, that our meat consumption actually does have an impact, puts price pressure on lower income countries and redistributes food. And so it really does matter. It's not that, okay, we eat less here, and then all of a sudden that food is used in Africa or Asia. It doesn't happen that way. And having a plant-based world or a vegan world does not solve world hunger. So I also want to hit that point really hard. A fully plant-based world does not solve world hunger. People who might say like, well, vegan, if it's a vegan world with a vegan ethic would solve world hunger. I was like, okay, if we had a world that was plant-based with a vegan ethics, then yes, that's a really big ask. Yeah.
Right. So what we're all trying to do is just make an impact, because if you don't address anything, because the big picture, you'll see like Ethiopia, or other countries exporting grains in order to get weapons. You're not going to fix that. But so much else is dependent upon the price of grains being too high for certain populations to afford it. And where that's the case, as you know, supply and demand. You could talk a lot about that. And in fact, if you'd like to talk a little bit about supply and demand now, please feel free to have people understand that what we are doing collectively does make a big impact.
Yeah, it does. And again, we are really practical. So that's why I want to say decreasing, at least shifting away from being so reliant and dependent on animal sourced foods. And also it's drastically increasing. It's continuing to increase. So there's all the pressures from it increasing. If we were to increase slower, that's that's good, but we, you know, we need to decrease, and we need to decrease significantly our current consumption. And that has to happen if we're talking about real food security globally. And again, it's not some utopian ideal that like, oh, if we stop eating meat and dairy, if we eat plant-based, that there's no world hunger. That's not what we're saying, but it has to be part of the solution. It's common sense. It's about resource use. It's about greenhouse gases. You know, climate change is a hunger multiplier. You know, we can touch on that a little bit later. And it does make a difference. So in terms of supply and demand, I try to make it simple. So again, it's not that we don't eat the food here and then it can be all of a sudden it's in Ethiopia, right? That's not the case. But we are in an interdependent global food system, and demand in one area impacts prices in other areas. And so, you know, we could see during 2008 when there's a grain shortage, right? Prices go up. So if grain is less available, any kind of grain, and that's corn, any kind of food staples, any kind of crops, if there's a shortage, it increases price. Decreased supply increases price relatively. And, you know, some things are commodities and they're tied to other types of things, but just as a whole, that's how supply and demand works. And one of the easiest ways to see it is if you think about, if there's a whole bunch of something that's on sale and you can, you have to give it away cheaper to get rid of all of it because you have, I like to say apples. So say if I've got 100 apples and 10 people, and I was like, oh, I got to get rid of these apples before the market closes. You know, then I'm saying, hey, they're a quarter. And okay, I can get rid of my 100 apples. But say I just have one apple and 10 people want it. Now, maybe I normally would charge $1 for an apple, but I could probably get $5 for that apple if there's 10 people who want an apple. But it's going to be the wealthy, right? So at a quarter, lots of people can afford apples. Everybody's got plenty of apples, and it's reasonable. And so you could think, say I have 100 apples and I've got 10 people, but then Smithfield over here is like, you know what? We want 9 of those apples for pigs. So now they take it. Now, again, I have one apple, I have 10 people, you know, or I could, maybe I have 3 apples and 10 people, right? But those prices are going to be increased, and not everybody's going to get an apple, get food, because it's got to go to the pigs who are going to be mated to meat. So, you know, not hating on the pigs, but just in terms of the inefficiency of the system.
Yeah, and it has a real impact on the price that humans are paying for the food that humans eat.
Yeah, you know, we're bidding for it. And that's what happens is when you need all this extra food to be used for animals to make meat and dairy, then, and also eggs, but that bids up the price, and you're competing with the world's poor, basically, for that, and bidding up the price. And they're so sensitive to any kind of shocks. You know, when you are living on the margins like that, the even the smallest increases takes food off the table.
Absolutely. But isn't it something you mentioned before, that organizations are willing to look at this problem, they understand just how many resources we're putting toward animals, and yet before saying, let's try and discuss consuming less, they'll talk about population and reducing populations. That's easier than changing one's diet. They'll talk about using biotechnology as opposed to just changing one's diet and having a societal understanding. And until, you know, it's never really been talked about in many countries where you have public service announcements. China started to do it in 2016, where they had a less meat, less heat campaign. And they were talking about reducing their consumption by 50% using public service announcements and videos and celebrities and whatnot. But until we've tried it, why are we saying it doesn't work?
Yeah, well, you got to look at who's doing the research. So the research that I was reading was the International Food Policy Research Institute, which is a U.S. think tank. A lot of the research is U.S. think tanks or U.S. and European think tanks, at least that's reaching a lot of the major decision makers globally, you know, the power centers. And it's a lot easier to say, hey, folks over there need to have fewer kids because, you know, than to say, well, we need to eat less meat. We need to, you know, we need to change our habits and to put the focus on population. And again, there's all kinds of gender and racial biases that go along with that. You're basically telling women of color, stop having so many children. And also, who's got access to family planning and just to quickly, I mean, these are such sensitive topics, but the huge difference between having, you know, access to family planning versus forced sterilization and pressure around those types of things. And there's also, interestingly, when you have populations that have enough nourishment and you educate girls, population rates decrease naturally. So if women are empowered, women and girls are educated and empowered, it naturally decreases population. So if you care about those things, then, you know, it is connected. That's, you know, that's the way to do it. But also look at our own consumption.
Right. And of course, we're talking about a much bigger picture and a different topic when we talk about the fact that the people making decisions, and the people doing research, are not the people living in the countries where their families don't have enough to eat and their communities do not have enough to eat. In much the same way as the people making environmental laws in the United States and other developed countries are not the people who are disadvantaged, low-income, people of color. Those people are the people who experience the downside of the pollution that is created by the decisions of people who won't be impacted by it. And that's obviously a problem that we're not going to solve today, but that's the context of the issues that we're talking about.
Yeah. And also what's unfortunate is that you can still look at tech solutions for doing things more efficiently. You can still look at, you know, healthy ways of looking at population and family planning and reduce our massive consumption. So it's not even that we have to choose, right? So there's no legitimate reason for them not to say we need to be reducing consumption, at least reducing, quote, overconsumption, even the concept of, you know, what's over, do we need to eat animals?
Sure.
But even among people who are advocates of animal consumption, that there still is, sometimes you'll at least hear they'll do like a quality over quantity. And so I would think from a meat proponent perspective, that's the fairest. Like, you know, we support plant-based solutions, and I will make the case for plant-based solutions over meat-based solutions. But I at least can appreciate, if you are going to be a meat proponent, that would be the way to go, say quality over quantity, and to then say reduce quantity. And there are some folks who will say, look, you know, we do need to reduce consumption. We, you know, they won't advocate plant-based, but they will say reduced consumption has environmental benefits.
Right.
And that is also kind of where we have a website called Humane Facts, Humane Facts, FACTS, not facts like a fax machine, facts like the truth, .org, where we talk about kind of the deceptiveness of humane labeled meat and things of that nature. But there are, if you are concerned about animal welfare, some is worse than others. And if you are somebody who is concerned about those types of things, then also not only does meat reduction help because we're eating fewer animals, so that's saving animal suffering, but then that gives more room for higher care. You know, again, we are plant-based organizations, so, but, you know, anything that will have animals suffer less, and the best way to have animals suffer less is to not eat them at all. But for folks who do support it, like, that would be a tactic that they should be happy to support reduction efforts, because a reduction effort would allow more space for higher welfare also. So I'm just saying they should be on our side regardless.
Right, right. And this is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We're speaking to Dawn Moncrief, founder and president of A Well-Fed World, an international hunger, relief, and food security organization. You can find out more about Dawn and A Well-Fed World at www.awellfedworld.org, awellfedworld.org. And another reminder that you're listening to WUSB, and of course, WUSB only survives because you contribute. We contribute to you all year with mind-expanding programs like this one that actually put you in a position to do something meaningful for the world by virtue of examining
and modifying your daily actions. Now you get to contribute. Call 631-632-6901. That's 631-632-6901 and contribute to WUSB's all-volunteer radio station, to Radiothon. There are premiums you can get. You can see those at WUSB.FM, WUSB.FM. Whatever you choose to do, however you choose to contact us, get in touch. Give back for this programming that I know you are enjoying and learning from.
Thanks for spelling out the website. Also, if anybody needs the short version, you can just use our initials, the four initials, AWFW.org. So the initials for awellfedworld.org, or even plants4hunger.org. So plants4hunger.org will take you to our website.
Dawn, a well-fed world's website mentions that Gandhi brought widespread attention to conceptualizing certain types of hunger and poverty as a form of violence. Mm-hmm. Explain that characterization. And of course, it does make a lot of sense.
We have a section specifically on the website with the idea of hunger as a form of structural violence. Under our issues section, there's a section on hunger. And one of the things to distinguish between violence and, say, harm, right, is the intention behind it. And so, you know, I think a lot of us would like to think, you know, oh, it's unfortunate that there's hunger, but it's not just unfortunate. It's there because not only do we not care enough to put resources towards it, but there are advantages sometimes. Like, I mean, you can see in conflict for sure that food is being deprived as a weapon. And so that's very real in conflict, where food will be used as a weapon, or, you know, depriving populations of food. But again, that's actually only maybe like 10% of hunger is around conflict. So a lot of it's structural, and it is a way of keeping populations, you know, it has the ripple down effect of what we were talking about, you know, kind of before we started the show a little bit. You know, if you have children who aren't well fed, they can't do well in school. They can't learn. They don't physically develop well enough. And Frances Moore LePay, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet and is still very active and has great work out there, has this also really amazing article. One of the things I like about a well fed world is we get into some of the numbers that other people don't really showcase. And this one is, it's Frances Moore LePay. If you look her up, it's called Hunger Matters. We also have it linked on our website. And it talks about the ways in which hunger is undercounted. But she was saying, you don't have to have this starvation. The idea that we have, like, just, you know, children just starving to death, it doesn't have to be that bad to cause this irreparable harm. And that it lasts for generations. So again, your brain doesn't develop enough, your body, you don't have the energy to kind of work your way out of poverty, to push back against unjust systems. And that's within your own country and then also internationally. So it, you know, it benefits the powers that be to not have a population that can kind of rise up and protest too much. So it is also intentional. And that's when the difference between, if you say, you know, you fall and hit your arm, you know, that's an accident. If somebody punches you, that's violence. And so that type of not prioritizing getting food and nourishment to those who need it is also a form of structural violence. Again, that's generational.
And it certainly is a form of violence. Not talking about it is a form of violence, despite the
silence,
fact that
silence is violence, right? Silence is violence.
Silence is violence. Violence. Yeah. especially for those people who are in a position to do something about it. And not for the Joe on the street who's talking about it and doesn't understand, but for people who understand and continue the system. And it's interesting, you're mentioning Frances Moore LePay a lot. I had read her book back in the 1980s, I guess early 80s, late 70s. Mm-hmm. And that had an impact on me. I remember hearing about hunger in general when I was a very young child, and it was unfathomable. It was like, wait a minute, something's very, very wrong here. And yet people are just talking about it like it's kind of normal. and then Francis Moore-Lepay, and then all of that. And that's been in my consciousness for, what is it, 50 years now?
Yep.
40, yeah. Yeah, just a whole long time. So it's great to hear that she's still out there and doing the job.
She is, and her daughter also, they're a dynamic duo.
Yeah.
And it is great that she's still out there. She's kind of the pioneer. So, I mean, I assume you probably have lots of very well-informed listeners and who might be familiar with kind of the idea of, like, say that, you know, cows eat 16 times more crops, than you know, 16 pounds of food for each pound of food that they produce, that there's this, like, inefficiency. It's called a feed conversion ratio. And she was the one that really brought that to the public view in terms of how much animals eat who are raised for food, how much livestock, I don't like to use the term livestock, but just for clarity, you know, that how much food animals being used for food eat versus how much food that they produce and the inefficiencies and the environmental consequences of that. So, and 16 to 1 was, you know, when you think about it, it's like, what, 16 pounds, that a cow eats 16 pounds to produce 1 pound of hamburger. But it's actually even worse than that. So those, you know, those were her early numbers before there was a lot of research. But if you look at the industry, the meat industry, they'll say 7 pounds, which even if it was 7 pounds, like, that's a lot, you know, you're like, wow, 7 pounds, but it's actually 25 pounds. And so again, this kind of harkens back to the numbers that we, you know, see and try to shed light on in terms of, you know, what comprises those numbers, how are they gotten and who's using what. So we rely on conservative mainstream papers, we like the UN, Nature, World Resources Institute. We can show even IFPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute, like, their own research shows what we should be doing, even if their conclusions don't say this is the actions that we recommend. Their own research shows why we should be reducing meat consumption, but it's actually 25 to 1. And the reason why you will have the meat industry say it's 7 to 1, that cows eat 7 pounds, and I'm saying, well, but no, it's actually 25, is because they use a live weight ratio. So they can make the case that they're telling the truth, but it's a live weight. And so once you take out the bones and the blood and all the inedible parts, you get about a third of what's left, and then fat, and it's packaged in that quote edible weight, what actually goes to retail is about a third of the actual live weight. So that's why they'll say 7, but it's really like 25. And to give a sense of how much that is, if you take a 100 calorie hamburger patty, which is not much, I'm sure a quarter pounder is more than a 100 calories on that hamburger patty. That at 25 to 1, it took 2,500 global crop calories. That's how I like to think of it in terms of your global crop calories, right? Like, talk about, you know, taking our unfair share. That one little hamburger patty takes 2,500 calories away from the global food supply. And that is enough to feed a grown adult, you know, a big adult, not even a little adult. I can get by on 2,000 or less. And this
right,
is
for a whole day for that.
For a whole day, one little hamburger yep. patty. And so that's where we, you know, conceptualize meat itself as a form of overconsumption. Because if you're eating a diet that has even just medium in meat and dairy, it's easily 10,000 calories you could be eating worth out of the global food supply. Hmm. And that's where, again, it's a form of overconsumption. It's a form of redistribution.
But it's not just that. When we look at one-to-one, we're looking at, yes, 25 pounds of feed crops to produce 1 pound of beef. But then you have to look at the fact that it's 10 billion land animals killed every year in the United States. And that produces all the meat and the dairy and the eggs. So it's 10 billion. These animals outnumber us, the ones that we're raising for food. They outweigh us. They out-eat us. And as a result of all the food that they're eating and all that's coming out the other ends, they out-poop us by a long shot. And so it is creating some really big problems. And that's not to mention the trillions of animals that are taken from the sea, and both farm-raised and wild-caught. So, you know, it's just an enormous amount of food that's wasted before it ever even gets the chance to be eaten by a human. It's just wasted in the production. But what we hear more about is retail to consumer food waste. And they say that we lose about 30% of our food that way, which is enormous unto itself. But you say, you've described the waste associated with producing meat and other animal source foods as the ultimate form of food waste.
Yeah, I mean, so I just, you know, was talking about cows and 25-to-1, right, ratios.
Right.
So amongst the meat industry, the poultry industry, chicken industry, loves to tout their efficiency. So the smaller animals are more efficient in turning food crops into food, animal-based cooked food. So it's about 10 pounds to one for pigs, so 25 for cows, 10 pounds to one for pigs, and about two or so for chickens. And so they loved, like, look at this, like, we're 2-to-1, we're so efficient, right? You know, and when you're looking at those numbers, you're like, yeah, that is a lot more efficient to eat chickens. But 2-to-1 is a 50% ratio of waste. You're wasting 50%. So they still eat 200 calories and you only get 100 calories out of it. So it's inherently on its own a 50% waste. We're just saying, like, how awful it is that there's a 30% waste.
Right.
This is 50. And that's the most efficient. And that doesn't include chicken that's thrown out, right? So then you've got a waste multiplier because you have these animal-based foods that are then not all of it's eaten. So there's going to be waste amongst that. And so, yeah, if you care about food waste, then look at animal-based foods. They are themselves a form of food waste inherently. And, you know, nobody's publicly speaks out against food waste. I mean, you know, speaks out that it's not an issue, right? Everybody's against food waste, at least publicly. I'm sure the food manufacturers are happy to have food waste, right? Because it's more money for them.
Right.
But nobody otherwise, politicians or think tanks, nobody would say it's okay to have food waste. Everybody reasonably is against food waste, right? Why? If there's plenty of food, then why? Who cares if it's wasted? But people are concerned because it does matter. So if it matters that food is wasted, then it matters that we're wasting this by eating these resource-intensive animal products. So just think about, like, okay, well, if I care about food waste, why? And it's because it matters. And another, you know, I like to point to other things that show that it matters. And we had also talked about maybe touching on biofuels.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And so biofuels is the same kind of issue, right? Like, do the food crops go to feed people directly? Do the food crops go to feed animals for animal products, animal-based food products? Do the food crops go for fuel? And there's a lot of controversy about biofuels. And it was so controversial that the Special Rapporteur to the Right to Food at the UN actually had a moratorium of 5 years, like no biofuels, called for it, because he called biofuels a crime against humanity. Like, that's the UN Special Rapporteur to the Right of Food said that biofuels are a crime against humanity because they're diverting food crops away from feeding people towards fuel. So that's pretty meaningful. Like, this is really
makes sense.
I bring it up a lot because to me that just, it brings in the moral authority. If people are like, oh, Dawn, you know, you're, you know, vegans. If you were to look at a chart, we have this great chart that shows all the global crop calories and how they're allocated. And less than 5% of global crop calories are allocated towards biofuels. Well, more than a third, like 36%, this big chunk, I wish I had my graph, a big chunk of it is for food crops, right? Like, these are animal feed. And then this little bit is for biofuels. And they're calling biofuels the crime against humanity. It's like, no, if you care, if you want more food staples to be in the food supply, just eat less meat. That's going to easily clear up some of these feed crops being used. It's so drastic. Biofuels, less than 5% of global crop calories, and it's being called a crime against humanity. And feed crops are taking up more than a third.
Yeah, so there's something that makes changing people's diet away from eating animals, a place where we can't go. For some reason, it's just, I've spoken to less so these days, but in the past, people working on climate change who would not go out on a limb and mention the great potential of cutting climate change by cutting and changing what we eat. Even though they were all about consumption, 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 they had trouble saying the V word. And so why is that? Why is it so sacred that we cannot go there? Even though, as you mentioned, they can talk about biofuels as being a crime against humanity, and they have a fraction of the impact as animal products do.
Yeah, I think, there's a cognitive dissonance. I mean, we know that's kind of standard within the, you know, the plant-based vegan advocacy community. And so what I just really implore people to do is to not use your own actions to look at it and say, look, I'm not living up to my ideal on this, but this makes sense. This is common sense. Like we have the science. And, you know, one of the points I also like to make is that a lot of times, you know, vegetarians and vegans are kind of brushed off. It's like, oh, you're so sentimental or something. It's like, no, like we have the science. We have the science. Who's sentimental? Who's like clinging to that burger?
Exactly.
No, right. No, don't take my burger. Like we can show you all the science. Here's how it's terrible for your health. Here's the environmental consequences, the animal suffering.
Yes, and, please take take the emotions and sentiment out of the equation, please. Just look at the facts. Look at what we all stand for, right?
Right. And whatever, and again, whatever the issue is, and that's, I touched a little bit on that in the opening where I can see, you know, multiple sides of things, but on every issue, the only issues where like vegan plant-based doesn't like win is that the convenience factor, right? Like it's not convenient, but that's because not enough people do it. So if we had it more in society and it was more popular and there was a greater demand, that's just social. So that's just the convenience factor, and then also being socially supported around it. There's kind of a concept of a vegan ally. It's a little bit controversial, but I'm all for it myself. So sometimes, you know, diet change is hard for some people. There's emotional attachments. There's, you know, all kinds of baggage that goes along. I say this as also somebody who's a sugar addict. I was able to go vegan much easier than quitting sugar. I still haven't done it. I'm on and off and on and off. And I don't, you know, there's emotional eating. And so I actually, despite being vegan since 98 and vegetarian since 89, I still have a lot of like kind of sympathy because I understand emotional eating and attachment and that it is hard. And so even though I'm teasing like meat eaters about like, no, don't take my cheeseburger, and vegetarians like, don't take my cheese.
Yeah, and you don't.
Because I was that way too when I was vegetarian and I was learning about veganism. I'm like, oh, they're coming from my pizza and ice cream. And it, sure. We have it a lot better today. Like that was 98. There wasn't all the great alternatives. But, you know, once I did the research, I was like, oh, darn it. And it still took me a while. I was doing my master's thesis on the benefits of plant-based foods for global hunger. And I was like popping M&Ms. you know, and I'm like, I know it's bad, you know, so if we could just step outside and say, look, my actions aren't living up to my ideals, but this is what's best, you know, and I drive a car, all kinds of things, right? Like in terms of like frozen foods or junk foods or consumption, you know, buying the extra pair of sneakers you don't need. I don't know, whatever it is, like, we're
not perfect.
We inherently don't live up to our ideals, right? Like that's the
right
idea. But like try to get closer, or at least don't undermine it when that's kind of the right action, right? And you say like, no, that would be helpful. Even if my personal habits aren't there, this would be helpful if there was reduced global meat consumption, and I'm not going to speak out against it. I'll speak for it, even if I'm not living up to it. If I have friends who are going plant-based, I will be supportive and not mock them. We'll make, you know, sure we have some food available, I would like to see a lot more. I actually do see it happening more. And so, you know, hopefully that trend will continue, because even then, if somebody themselves is not being plant-based, if they're supportive, maybe the people in their sphere will be more likely if they get props, right? Like if you're like, hey, good job, that's great, you know, and it comes to be something more like smoking, right? Like everybody who smokes knows, oh, I shouldn't smoke. But they don't say, oh, people should smoke. they don't try to make it sound like it's good. They know, like, yeah, no, I know.
Right.
Like that would be a huge step in the right direction if we were able to reframe meat consumption. And when I say meat, I meat and dairy, you know, any of it is just one of those things. It's like, yeah, I know it should be better. I'm working on it. Or good for you, be in support of the people who drink less or don't, you know, smoke or don't smoke, and just kind of have it framed in those types of, I mean, it's actually really, it's a really good analogy actually.
But the pushback is so strong. I see it with plant-based meats. Someone posted something about someone from a university in California where they said something like the top ingredients or in plant-based meats are the same as the top ingredients in a dog food. And it turns out they were comparing a organic vegan dog food to like the, I don't know, Beyond Burger. And they were saying these 10 ingredients, or I'm just synopsizing, but basically it was the fact that the vitamins and minerals were all the same. They were both from pea protein, and they're making a case to make it sound disgusting. And that was spread online by people who feel very attached to their meat, and they don't want to see these plant burgers taking over, which, you know, the plant burgers are amazing. And as far as I'm concerned, represents an opportunity going forward, which is unprecedented and probably equals all the work that you and I and all the other people have done over many decades. It probably has the potential to change people's attitudes and habits as much as all that we've done. But it's really important because going forward, the UN and think tanks warn that global meat and dairy consumption will double by weight. And that was between 2000 and 2050. And a well-fed world has stated that as of 2022, the prediction was on track. So we really need to be considering not just what the impact right now is, but going forward, if we have more of this mega waste and a population that's also growing, continuing to grow, solutions then become very difficult.
Yeah, and you're right on that research. And, you know, that ties back in, you know, when you had mentioned about the 10 billion animals, land animals, just in the U.S. alone. And so that actually has remained pretty consistent. That was about what it was when I was first doing this research, which was back with that when that was, research was being put out there in the late 90s, so for 2000 to 2050. And at the time, I thought, oh, no way. I mean, it can't, because, you know, because of the environmental consequences, and, you know, surely that's not going to happen. Things will change, and it has stayed on track. And so 10 billion still in the U.S. It is about the same, but we're about past 80 billion now. And it was 50 billion when I was first doing this research around the late 90s to early 2000s. It was 50 billion animals. And, you know, just every time I look at the numbers, I'm like, it is still increasing. And it's past 80 billion now. And for 2050, it's looking on track to be about 120 billion. And the reason why you're like, well, you said it was double and it was 50 billion and 100 billion, which is like, is double, not 120 billion, but it's doubled by mass. So because of the number of poultry to pigs and cows and things like that, the actual number of animals more than doubles. So the number of animals goes from 50 billion to like 5 million an hour being killed to 80 billion now to 120 billion by 2050, if things stay on track. And I would, it might not get there, but unfortunately, I think if it doesn't get there, it's because climate change and the resulting economic crisis. So it's either the environmental destruction and changes that are happening because of climate change that undermine the food system, including animal agriculture, and or the economic system that gets undermined, and so that the economic collapse could be impacting it. But I mean, why do we have to wait for that to take it out? You know, we need to be proactive.
Yeah, we're running out of time. So I wanted to give you a couple of minutes, which is all we have, to talk about a well-fed world's method of approaching this.
All right, well, then I will be super quick. So first off, please check out our website at awfw.org. We do a lot of research. We're doing a lot now with climate. So since 2006, livestock's long shadow, climate. It's about the methane, the photosynthesis. We've got more on numbers using the 100-year timeframe versus the 20-year timeframe. Oh, we should have another session just on climate and meat consumption. I'm sure you've done a lot, but we've got some points that don't usually get hit on that. But we have a climate-friendly food guide. It's free. You can download it or contact us and we'll send you a print copy. So visit our website for that. Also, we do we support plant-based hunger relief. And so we don't grow the food ourselves, but we partner with groups in doing work in their own community. It's already plant-based. We don't go in and impose the model. And we will just send them 100% of the money from our Plants for Hunger. We're supporting some great vegan feeding programs in Ukraine right now. And we also Ethiopia and you know, a bunch of other countries. We've supported programs in 95 countries, more than $15 million over the past 15 years. So some really great work, but it goes to groups that do not have a lot of access to money. So even if you are not vegetarian or vegan yourself, it makes a lot of difference because they're small groups. So, you know, we got a whole thing against Heifer International and supporting animal feeding. They're very big. So if you like them, they're huge. They have their fundraising budget is more than $20 million. Their CEO gets more than $500,000. I'm not worried about LIBO because it's just all on their 990. So it's true. We support the small groups. So it'll make a big difference.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Dawn, thank you so much for being with us. I want to just give you another 30 seconds to let you say anything else that you'd like to leave our audience with.
Oh, I guess that's it. But gift giving. So if you want to give a gift, you can give the Plants for Hunger gift solutions. And we just have a lot of great resources online, grazingfacts.org. If you think you're pro-grazing, go to grazingfacts.org. We have a partnership with the Center for Biological Diversity, and there's a lot of information on that for the pro-grazing listeners that you have, or people who just have questions.
And what raising is that?
Grazing. Regenerative grazing. So a lot of people think, oh, that's good for the climate. It's not. Whatever little carbon sequestration, it doesn't match the methane emissions from the cattle, which are 3 to 4 times higher than factory farmed cattle. So grazing actually has more emissions. Plus all the deforestation from whether it's feed or grazing is taking out photosynthesis, which is our natural way to fight carbon dioxide and pull it out of the air. We're deforesting and we're losing the trees. So yeah, check out our climate-friendly food guide.
All right. And we will be doing a show on regenerative agriculture coming up because it needs to be addressed. The cows are not the solution. All right. Dawn Moncrief, thank you so much again for joining us. This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We've been speaking to Dawn Moncrief, founder and president of A Well-Fed World, an international hunger relief and food security organization advancing the benefits of plant-based foods and farming. You can find out more about Dawn and A Well-Fed World at either awellfedworld.org or awfw.org. Or Plants for the number 4 hunger.org.
Yeah, whatever you can remember.
Whatever you can remember, but anything. And we'll have those all listed along with the archive. Thanks again, Dawn.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this evening's show. Join us again on the first and third Fridays of each month at 6 p.m. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives, our great lineup with hosts from Eugene Zamperon to Courtney Bozick, John Scardina, and more, sharing cutting-edge information on health, our environment, social issues, and so much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak for what's right. Consider a shift in your diet to one that creates a well-fed world. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing 4 or multi-legged friends. And finally, remember to enjoy each moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share. Good night. As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life. All of us at WUSB want to thank our listeners for many years of support, and that support that actually keeps us on the air. The way we get your support is via radiothons, and you can do that by going to www.wusb.fm
and filling out the online pledge form. Or 631-632-6901. So why would you choose to donate to WUSB with all the other radio stations out there? I have to ask you in return, why you choose to listen to WUSB? If you're listening to this show, you know that for years, we've been bringing you life and world-changing information. We not only cover topics that you won't hear on other radio shows or cable TV, but we have in-depth discussions of those topics versus sound bites. And unlike other radio stations, all of the amazing DJs and talk show hosts on WUSB are volunteers. So what's the difference when you listen to all volunteers? Well, the difference is that these programs are created because the DJ or talk show host has a passion about sharing either fine music or meaningful, life-changing information with you. The contents of these shows springs from our insights, creativity, and yes, passion. Our 24/7 schedule is made possible by a volunteer staff of over 160 Stony Brook students, faculty, staff, alumni, and community residents. 168 hours per week of innovative and high-quality programming.
WUSB.FM.
631-632-6901. Just about every time I flip on WUSB, I get something unexpected. Most of the music is new to me. The talk is always interesting. That's the beauty of diversity. You don't just get what you signed up for over and over again. You get something new. You get something creative. And that's what makes us special.
WUSB.FM.
The content here awakens your imagination and could help you to grow in ways that you didn't know that you could. And it could also teach you about how to live a longer, healthier life while taking steps that will transform society to one that is clean, healthy, compassionate, and a much better place for future generations to live. Time has proven the information we have passed along to you has been spot on.
WUSB.FM.
Well over a decade ago, we brought you programming about the disease preventing and reversing benefits of a whole foods plant-based diet. During that time, fad diets have come and gone and been proven to be short-term fixes at best. What you've been hearing right here has stood the test of time, and now it's known to be able to prevent and reverse diseases from heart disease to stroke, diabetes, and so much more, and it can even be part of a diet lifestyle modification program that can reduce your risk of cancer.
WUSB.FM.
And we've also set the record straight on many, many other issues that you rarely hear any kind of in-depth, meaningful discussion on. And of course, since that time, we've experienced the 10 hottest years on record. We've seen the ramping up of major storms. Sea levels have risen. Wildfires are destroying cities and more. So if this show and all the other great shows on WUSB have helped you or given you joy, please consider going to WUSB.FM. and filling out the online pledge form. Or 631-632-6901. We give to you all year. Now it's your turn to play your role by supporting this station.
WUSB.FM.
631-632-6901. Tune in and pledge today.
The rich, feed the poor, tell their own old rich no more. I love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I on bleeding, nation bleeding, still more bleeding economy. Life is funny, skies are sunny, bees make honey, who needs money, monopoly.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.